Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Pocket Limp Podcast. I'm Rick Henderson, and I'll be your host this week as we look at the latest tech news, review a hot new product, and chat to a top tech industry luminary. I'll be joined by our contributing editor Cam Bunton, who will guide us through OnePlus Nord, the company's forthcoming phone and prospective range that hopes to shake up the mid-range mobile market. Our resident PC gaming expert Adrian Willens will also give us the lowdown on the Acer Nitro 5, a games laptop that features very decent spec for under a grand, plus looks at gaming notebooks in general. And Stuart Miles will be talking to the UK boss of Bolt, Samuel Rossetti, in a very timely interview as the UK enters the trial phase of e-scooters hitting London streets. But first, back to Cam to give us a perspective on OnePlus's imminent plans to take over the mid-range. So Cam, tell me more about the OnePlus Nord and what the whole concept is.
So the OnePlus Nord, by the sounds of it, it's sort of OnePlus's new mid-range device. So for the past few years, they've been making purely flagship phones because they've been all about giving you the best speed and the best performance possible in their phones. But what that's meant over the last couple of years is that prices have increased significantly. So where OnePlus phones used to be known for being really affordable flagship powered phones, they've now gone up to prices over £500, £600, £700, even up to almost £900 if you get the top spec one. So the OnePlus Nord is about essentially bringing those prices back down again to below $500, which equates to about £400 in the UK. So that means slightly less powerful, and presumably it's going to be less premium as well. But we're not sure because they haven't actually announced all the details yet.
So is it a device or a range of devices?
Both. By the sounds of it, they've been referring to this Nord product line as a product line, but at the same time calling the phone the OnePlus Nord. So it seems like it's going to be a new family of devices, but again, without them saying exactly what it means, we don't know. But they have done interviews in the past, over the past few weeks, where they've talked about making more affordable devices again, as well as bringing other categories of devices into the market, be it smart homes or smart TVs, which actually they've already started doing in other regions.
Is this OnePlus essentially hitting the reset button, or is it an extended line, like an extra line, and they'll still be doing like the OnePlus 8 and the OnePlus 8T?
Yeah, it seems like it's an extended line. It's like it's sort of their new line within their brand of more affordable devices for people who maybe haven't been able to afford the phones that they've been releasing over the past couple of years. Like some of their early fans who really like OnePlus and are really involved, love the brand, love what it stands for, but haven't been able to buy the phones because they're just too expensive now. So OnePlus Nord seems to be about making something a bit more accessible for them without losing too much in terms of power and speed. And camera. That's another thing they've actually spoken about recently.
Do you think actually that the mid-range is going to become a bigger market now? We've got an awful lot of flagships on the market. We've got a lot of phones that people can't really afford very easily, even on quite extortionate contracts. So do you think the mid-range is an area where not just OnePlus, but other companies are going to look to exploit even more so in the coming year?
Yeah, I think so. It's a funny one because when we were all watching like the iPhone pushing prices up past the £1,000 mark, and then soon after that, Samsung and other companies started doing it, it soon became clear that they were sort of pushing the top tier or the top prices way up, which means now suddenly there's a bit more space in between the £200 phones and the £1,000 phones. So then they can fill that space with these sort of higher performance mid-range devices. And we've seen it from LG, the LG Velvet, uses the same processing power that the OnePlus Nord is going to use. Now, there's actually a phone by a company called Realme, which is sort of a sub-brand or offshoot of Oppo, which is in the same family of brands as OnePlus. The Realme X50, that uses that same processor. So it seems like there's a new wave of those phones coming in with that processor and with price points under £600.
I mean, OnePlus originally made its name for as we've already mentioned, for coming into a market with high spec but low prices. Yeah. But that market now is being sort of like adopted by a lot of Chinese manufacturers, other Chinese manufacturers.
Yeah.
Some of which people wouldn't have heard of before. Do you think that we're getting to a point where brand loyalty is becoming less important because and quality of device is becoming more important?
I mean, in some ways, yes. But I think one of the things that's interesting about OnePlus is they often will talk about their community and do things for their community because they want them to feel like they're in this special club. So they've been there since the beginning where they did this sort of excitement and hype around a ticket-based pre-ordering system. And they've done the same again with the OnePlus Nord, where there's like a limited run, almost like a limited pair of sneaker drop. You know how you have to get in on those raffles for some really high class limited edition trainers from Nike or whatever. Now, the OnePlus Nord launch has got that sort of feel to it. So it feels like they pay a lot of attention to their community, to the point where when they request new things in the software or request things to be added to the hardware, they actually take that on board and add it to their phone. So then the community feels like they've been listened to, and they feel valued. And so they're more likely to stick with OnePlus because they feel like they're part of that club. So I think a lot of those fans who love OnePlus would be reticent to join any other brand because then they would lose that sense of community and belonging that OnePlus seems to foster with its fans.
So is this a welcome return from OnePlus or by OnePlus to its older marketing strategy or its older sort of almost the punk strategy of the smartphone business? Because I remember it came along when the business was entirely dominated by both Samsung and Apple.
Yeah.
And presented an almost indie alternative. Do you think that this marks a return to that OnePlus that we kind of lost in recent times?
Yeah, it feels like it. You know, when you're watching some of the strategy that they're using on social media with their new OnePlus Nord Instagram handle, it's a lot less big name corporate manufacturer and a lot more like, hey, we're indie, we're cool, we're rough. Look, we're swearing in our videos. That kind of approach to it to make them feel a bit more edgy. So they're definitely returning to that sort of strategy. But the thing that gets to me is that obviously now OnePlus isn't that company that needs to do that anymore. They are one of the big flagship smartphone makers now. And so they're taking this approach, hoping that people don't notice that they're a company that's capable of shipping out millions of phones at a time, but limiting the pre-sale run to like 100 units just to build hype and excitement. So there is that side of it. And I guess some people might enjoy it, but at the same time, this is a big company now. They don't necessarily need to do that.
I think my final question is, why Nord? What does Nord mean?
Oh, so I was, it's hard to be positive and not cynical about this, but OnePlus Nord, they said, Carl Pei is one of the original co-founders of OnePlus, and he tweeted something about it representing the true north direction for the company. They've got this focus and they're going to stick to it. It's their value system. I don't think it means too much, to be honest, to me, but that's what they've said.
Excellent. Thank you, Cam. Thanks for that insight.
No worries.
Still to come, Adrian will be with me to review the Acer Nitro 5, a budget gaming laptop that doesn't shirk when it comes to spec.
When you talk about budget laptops, especially when it's cramming in things like NVIDIA's RTX graphics cards and Intel's latest CPUs in there, you expect it's going to end up being it's going to compromise in some areas.
Now though, did you know that until very recently it was illegal to ride e-scooters on the pavements or indeed the roads of the UK? Only small zones such as the Olympic Park in East London had legalised use of rental scooters. But this week, the UK entered its first major trial phase of the legalisation of electric powered scooters, with rental firms now allowed to offer them as a transport option. In a timely interview, Stuart talked to one of the industry's big hitters, Samuel Rossetti, the managing director of Bolt UK, about the government's scheme and much more. Enjoy.
Brilliant. Okay, so let's probably start this off nice and easy in just kind of giving us a potted history of Bolt in where you've come in and where you kind of feel you sit within the e-scooter rental business or beyond.
Yeah, so I mean, Bolt as a global platform, mobility platform, launched circa sort of 6 years ago and was originally built as a sort of a taxi operator app to assist with people digitally ordering taxis. And as the PHV sort of market shifted globally and people started looking at private hire vehicles as more of a cost efficient alternative to taxis, then we shifted towards PHV a few years later. I think from memory, and I would hope that my memory serves, 2017, 2018 was when, you know, micromobility first started to really hit the scene with a few of the US guys starting to put scooters on the streets. And into 2018, we saw this positive trend in uptake of micromobility services in some cities around the world. So we had our first play in 2018. When we launched Paris, and I was lucky enough to actually have not been a part of the launch week, but I was over in Paris for the month afterwards, helping with some operations there, and was able to see the uptake, and it was incredible how quickly people adopted or were at least willing to try this new form of transport, which was just so different to what had been there before.
Now, if anybody's been traveling over the last couple of years, you know, 2 years ago, if you were traveling to the States, certainly on the West Coast, you would have seen scooters, electric scooters around all over the place in San Francisco and sort of in that whole sort of Silicon Valley area and other cities across America. Then it felt that last year in the summer, you know, whatever European city you went to, you know, whether it was Lisbon or Paris or what have you, there were e-scooters around there. We haven't seen them in the UK, and that's because of the laws are very different here in the fact that it's illegal currently to ride an e-scooter on the streets of anywhere. Why do you think the law should change?
Well, I think that the shift towards micromobility helps, you know, in particular, like when we're talking about London, which is where our current operations sit with our private hire vehicle operating in London. You know, there's a real push towards sustainability and environmental impact. And when you look at micromobility and what that can bring to the table in terms of low emissions, especially in a city, like I said, like London, which is just so congested and so urbanly dense, it's got nothing but great benefits for the environment. And given the current circumstance we find in ourselves in with the pandemic, it also allows people to travel without putting themselves at arm's length of other people. So it allows for that socially distant piece to continue from now until the future, until we see other rules around relaxing some of these standards coming into effect.
Now, the UK government, the Department for Transport, has talked about doing trials. What are you hoping, you know, what sort of framework are you hoping the trials will include to make these things safe and usable and you know, for both you and for the riders?
Well, we're involved in pretty much conversations up and down the UK at the moment. So most of the local boroughs have put their hand up and said we are interested after DfT made their announcement that they're looking heavily at this a month or so ago. So, you know, the conversation piece that we've been involved in has been around things like data sharing, you know, where I think we're one of the few operators that's quite keen for the data sharing piece. not least because we are a multimodal app. You know, you can rent scooters or take one of our private hire cars from the same app, and that gives us obviously a significant advantage in terms of the data that we collect, because we know what short trips are taking place on our PHV part of our operations, and where micromobility can step up and help to take some of the load off that part of the operations. In some of our other global markets, we've seen sort of up towards 9-10% of users that have started using scooters move away from short sort of 3-mile journeys, which is, you know, a positive trend. And we're also looking at things, you know, around the requirements of the scooters. We've custom built an in-house model, which again, a little bit different to how some of our competitors have launched. We've gone with an in-house model that is completely modular, which allows us, you know, a much longer lifespan for that scooter. In the early days, when scooter frenzy hit us, the big concern was around, you know, how long will what was a retail scooter survive on streets, in particular like Paris, like you said, or in Portugal or in Spain, where, you know, these are cobblestone streets in some of the capital cities, Rome being another example. And, you know, so building this scooter in-house has allowed us to take all of those factors and take the lifespan of a scooter from weeks, if not, you know, 1 or 2 months to 36 months with the current model that we're looking to roll out. And, you know, that scooter has been sent to one of the local testing houses in the UK to make sure that it is considered sort of fit and proper for purpose and pass the standards that were put down by that centre. So, yeah, we're hoping that the conversations that we're having with boroughs and these authorities is that we get pilots that allow operators to get fleets out there, gauge you know, how the public are using them, support the public with transitioning to this mode, especially considering we have additional safety features, things like beginner mode on the scooters as well, so that when you get on a scooter for the first time, you don't have the full scope and breadth of the power that the scooter is allowed to run at under the legislation. We allow you to put it into beginner mode, because from what we know from, you know, how accidents happen, it's pretty much consistent that the majority of incidents happen when people are still on their first trip. They're getting used to a scooter. So,
and that's, I suppose that's one of the questions I have, is a lot of people are worried about the safety of not only people on the pavements as these things whiz past, but also of the riders themselves. I've been a few times where I've been in San Jose at conferences and stuff and seen people just get wiped out, you know, sort of heavy crashes of scooters because the cars haven't seen them and stuff. What do you think needs to be done within the trial period, whenever it does start, to make sure that the use of scooters is safe for everybody?
Well, I think it really is city specific when it comes to sort of these incidents. When you look at a city like London comparative to where I'm from, I'm not sure if you picked up, but I do have the Aussie accent. You know, cycling in London in particular is, you know, pretty much the norm. There's a lot of cycle lanes, and both motorists and cyclists alike are very much aware of each other when they're complying with sort of the road rules. So with any form of new mobility or an introduction of a new vehicle, people just need to be made aware of the best way to use these. I don't think that we will see struggles in our cities if our users are following best practice and guides and suggestions. You know, we go through a brief guidelines when a user opens the app to explain how to use the scooter and local rules around how to use the scooter and the streets that they're deployed in. So I think it's just about everyone being conscious that this mobility is good for us and it's coming in for a valid reason. And with any change, there will be some bumps. And it's just about mitigating those and managing those in the same way that you do when, you know, new cars are released, you know, like autopilot functions, all this sort of stuff. As long as it's for the greater good and we're conscious of these changes and we learn to adapt, I think it should be you know, very successful to see these on the streets in the UK.
Now, when I was traveling over the last couple of years, and admittedly not traveling much at the moment, but when I was traveling, you'd find that certainly, you know, going to Lisbon or something, you'd see this explosion of e-scooters. You'd see lots of different brands, yourselves, Jump, Lime, all these different companies. What makes you feel that you stand out from the crowd of what some people would say, well, it's a scooter?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question, and I think there's a few points that I would drill home. One is that we have, you know, a track record of working with local authorities when we do launch our operations. I think exactly what you just said is what happened across the world in the frenzy that was scooters in 2017 and 18, where a lot of operators sort of launched without the cooperation and without the support of local government. And we saw those operators be punished severely in the US, being evicted from sort of their home streets. We obviously go in with a very different approach. We're going in working and collaborating with local authorities to make sure that whatever way we deploy is assisting them with their local strategies around moving people. And also that, you know, there's obviously a benefit against our PHV drive, PHV operations, where we can help shift people from those low mile journeys to scooters as well. So, you know, that's the sort of first piece. We really go in and we work with the local authorities. The second piece is the technology. And it's down to the hardware. It's not just how we run our digital app and our platform, but it's the hardware. As I said earlier, our new scooter is completely in-house built, modular. It's built for longevity so that we don't see our scooters in scrap heaps and sort of losing the benefit that they bring to the environment by ending up in landfill. It's about having a sustainable scooter that can be completely rebuilt as wear and tear takes place. And I think that really makes us stand apart.
Now, let's fast forward to a year's time. The trial has been and done. Say it's been approved on you know, to be used on UK streets. What do you see? Where do you see it all fitting in? Where do you see the sort of the end goal for Bolt? Is it the ability for anybody anywhere to pick up a scooter, or is it more than that? Is it less than that?
I think scooters, they need to make sense. You know, this isn't a fix for a massive problem outside of cities where there's a need for it. So I don't think we're that ambitious to see people, say, in rural Australia jumping on a scooter to get between farms. It's about you know, the solution being there for and solving for a specific problem. And the problem exists in cities where there's a desperate need for last mile that counters congestion and pollution. So for us, it would be continuing to grow our footprint in cities and in regions where this really is a solution for the problems that the local city faces. It's not just about getting in as many cities as we can, because, you know, one of our core internal values of Bolt is really around a sustainable future. So it is genuinely about contributing where it's needed.
I've always wondered this is my final question. I've always wondered, why do they have to be electric? Why can't you just put regular scooters that you use with the good old fashioned foot power and have that instead?
You know, it's true. I actually have one. So it is, I feel like I may be the best person in Bolt to answer that question, because I have a push scooter that I take out with my two sons. But the main reason that the scooters offer a solution is because, you know, when it comes to mobility and getting around, people more often than not need to get somewhere within a certain time period. And I try as I may to push my push scooter as quick as I can, you know, going up and down the sort of Fulham and Hammersmith area, there's no way that I would be able to get to where I needed to be in the same amount of time. and with, let's be quite honest, without being significantly sweaty along the way. So really, it's about getting people that have a need to get somewhere that may not be inclined to use a push scooter or even, you know, a bike, because, you know, there are bike solutions there as well. So it's what works best for individuals. This is meant to be an alternative, a choice, rather than the only solution to last mile.
Thank you very much.
And so we come to our review, with our own Adrian Willins being somewhat an expert on all things PC gaming, having built his own super rig. He's therefore perfect to look at one of the most intriguing games laptops around. He recently got to play with the Acer Nitro 5, a budget machine in gaming terms, to see if it's up to scratch or whether it cuts too many corners to hit an affordable price. Let's find out. So Adrian, you're here to talk about the Acer Nitro 5, which is a laptop that's been around for a while, but we recently got to see it ourselves. You got to play with it, and you call it an affordable gaming laptop. So what does an affordable gaming laptop actually mean? What budget is it in?
Well, the basic model, I think, starts under £1,000, which is in modern times very affordable, considering the other sort of high-end laptops we've been testing recently go up to $3,000 and above, which is a lot of money to spend. So when you talk about budget laptops, especially when it's cramming in things like NVIDIA's RTX graphics cards and Intel's latest CPUs in there, you expect it's going to end up being... it's going to compromise in some areas, and I feel like the Nitro 5 doesn't. And that is what's surprising about it. And also, there's other features in there that you wouldn't expect to see in a budget laptop. Things like fast refresh screen, 120 or 144 hertz refresh rate on the screen, which is not the bleeding edge, because I think the top end on laptops is probably about 300 hertz. But these sort of specifications you don't tend to see in the cheaper end laptops.
Explain, one of my big problems with gaming laptops is they normally... bricks and very heavy. The ones that I have experience with are essentially laptops, desktops masquerading as laptops. Is the Nitro 5 light and portable enough to be an everyday laptop as well as a gaming machine?
Yeah, I think so. It's not the thinnest I've tried. There are more expensive ones that are thinner and lighter, but most of the gaming brands are building thin and portable laptops now, and NVIDIA's Max-Q variants of graphics cards basically mean that you can put thinner processors in there and keep things slim as possible. And they're working, you know, every new variant of laptop that's released, and in even the latest Nitro 5, they work to improve the fan setup and the cooling pipes and make it thin as possible, but still improve in terms of cooling performance and make sure they still work well. So although this is chunky in some areas, for example, the bezels aren't the thinnest, it's quite lightweight and easy to carry around and use. And because it's only a 15.6 inch screen, it's not a huge thing either. So yeah, it's a good balance of that, I think.
One of the other issues I've always had with gaming laptops is using a trackpad rather than a mouse. Is it possible to play a first-person shooter on a gaming laptop, for example?
I don't tend to. I think most gamers would frown at you if you suggested such a thing. I'm testing an Asus one at the moment that's got a side-slung trackpad, which is a bit better, but like having it in the middle there is just a bit finicky. And the one on the Nitro 5 I found a bit awkward to use anyway. But there's multiple USB ports on there, so it's easy to plug in your own mouse and set up that way, and that's definitely preferable. And the other thing about these thinner gaming laptops is if you are using it on your lap, which is a position where you'd probably want to use the trackpad rather than a mouse, you'd soon find that you get pretty warm. So maybe plugging in a controller is another option. But these laptops don't tend to work that well on the lap for gaming, I found. They get quite hot. But the Nitro 5 does quite a good job. It didn't get too bothersome, which is a bonus, because there's nothing worse than getting a hot lap in the middle of the summer when it's pretty ridiculous anyway.
Unless you're playing a racing game, in which case hot laps are order of the day. Bad pun there. Right, the last thing about the Acer Nitro 5, because we're going to move on to something else in a second, is that I'd like to know is what are the caveats, what are the cutbacks to get down to that sub £1,000 mark does it make?
Well, there's the rub, and that's what I covered in the review, is if you go for the cheapest model possible, you end up with small storage space. I think the one I tested, for example, had a 256 gigabyte hard drive in it. It's NVMe still, so it's pretty fast. But as you know, the latest games, things like Red Dead Redemption and Call of Duty Modern Warfare, take up massive amounts of space. And I mean, if you put both, I don't even know if you'd be able to fit both those games on that size. I feel like you probably couldn't, and it would soon fill up. And obviously it's got Windows on there as well, and if you install anything else, you're basically going to fill those drives up quickly. So if you go for the base model, you'll soon find problems. But you can get up to two different drives in there. I think it goes up to a terabyte in total. So again, that's still not massive amount of storage, but you know, you are paying for a a budget laptop that you'd expect some compromise in. So storage space is going to be one of them, but there's always the option of an external drive as well, so there's plenty of workarounds for it.
Okay, well, let's now move on to a different end of the scale in some respects. The Gigabyte Aorus 15G, which is the most recent gaming laptop you've reviewed for Pocket Lint. Now, what does that offer that the Acer doesn't?
Well, Gigabyte's crammed in all sorts of interesting things in here. You've got, first of all, there's a mechanical gaming keyboard in there, which is pretty interesting. They've made that low slung and react fast to things as well, which is pretty nifty. It's a bit chunkier than the Nitro 5 because I think they've put more tech inside. But style-wise, it's really nice. They've also got this Microsoft Azure AI technology. I never sure how to pronounce that. That is meant to be artificial intelligence that improves the performance of the laptop based on the usage of it. So it learns what you're doing and then improves the performance overall. Also, this one has a 240 hertz screen on it. So it's got some of the sort of high-end specs for a more expensive gaming laptop. And I think this one starts at about £1,500. So it's not the most expensive. Obviously, that's going to vary depending on what specs you go for. But again, it's pretty nifty. And under the hood as well, there's a spot for another M2 drive, so you can actually install that yourself. Just take the underside off and you can install an extra NVMe drive, so you've got more storage space. So this one's appealing for a number of different reasons. And it's got loads of, like, not just hardware, but software enhancements to make your experience even more interesting.
And of course, it's got the RTX card in it, isn't it?
So it's
capable of ray tracing. So what would you say that ray tracing actually now brings? Because the thing is not only on PC gaming laptops and PC gaming desktops, especially with the RTX NVIDIA cards, ray tracing is a big deal because it's also coming to PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X. Now, what is ray tracing going to bring to gaming? Or is it bringing to gaming? Sorry, because PC gamers will cane me for saying that it's still yet to come.
Well, NVIDIA has been working closely with Microsoft on the DirectX 12 Ultimate recently as well. So they're trying to make it easier for more developers to bring ray tracing to more games in future. So yeah, you're saying it's going to appear on consoles, but we should also see more PC games with it as well. So just better visuals and easier access for everybody and across a wider range of cards, because there's rumored that NVIDIA is working on a few more RTX cards that are coming in the near future. So hopefully we should see, once that starts releasing, the prices of the RTX variants going down, and then more affordable access to ray tracing and just better visuals for everybody, really.
So going back to the previous two laptops, and you know, they obviously got this fantastic new technology, and gaming laptops in general, why do you think that gaming laptops have become so popular recently?
I think they can do a lot more than they used to be able to. Although some niggles for me when I'm using them is, like, battery life, for example, isn't great on a lot of the gaming laptops. But you can get a lot. The technology shrunk down so much that you can get a really powerful machine in something that's more portable than it used to be. And like, I feel like desktops used to be what you'd go for because you could get a lot more power out of them a lot more easily. But now things like the Max-Q graphics cards from NVIDIA slimmed down laptops, a lot more portable, a lot easier to use on the move, although you still need to be plugged in for gaming for the best experience. But, you know, if you creators and things that want to do video editing on them as well, also have that power under the hood to be able to use them. And the screen technology is just coming on in leaps and bounds as well. Obviously, faster refresh rates, as I said earlier, you can get up to 300 hertz refresh rates on these panels now. And because they're compact, it makes it easier to faster refresh rates, higher pixel counts. 4K screen on a 15.6 inch laptop is easier to drive and still get good performance out of, and they're pretty magnificent for the most part as well.
So my final question really is, if you've got £1,000 burning a hole in your pocket, would you go for a budget option like the Acer Nitro 5, or would you save up a bit more and get something slightly better?
Well, from what I saw from the Nitro 5, it's worth that sort of money, to be honest. Like I said, as long as you've got enough storage space, that'd be the only one consideration there. But the specifications on that laptop and the experience that I had make it worth that money, to be honest. I mean, I think it's always better to go bigger if you can afford it. But if you're desperate and you want something good but, you know, isn't going to let you down, then that's a worthwhile option.
Excellent. Cheers, Adrian. Alas, that's it for this week's Pocket Limp podcast. If you liked it, please feel free to leave a review on your listening platform of choice. Every kind remark definitely helps. I've been Rick Henderson, and I hope you join us again next week for more tech industry talk. Until then, tatty bye.